Well, this is my fourth Sunday with you, and I just want to say how much I appreciate that you're still showing up. I really do appreciate being here and your support, and thank you very much for all the kind words that you've shared with me in my time with you so far. Our reading today is going to come from Paul's letter to the church in Philippi. I'll be reading from chapter 1, verses 3 through 11. I thank God every time I remember you, constantly praying with joy in every one of my prayers for all of you, because of your sharing in the gospel from the first day until now. I am confident of this, that the one who began a good work among you will bring it to a completion by the day of Jesus Christ. It is right for me to think this way about all of you, because you hold me in your heart, for all of you share in God's grace with me, both in my imprisonment and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel. For God is my witness how I long for all of you with the passion of Jesus Christ. And this is my prayer, that your love may overflow more and more with knowledge and full insight to help you determine what is best, so that on the day of Christ, you may be pure and blameless, having produced the harvest of righteousness that comes through Jesus the Christ for the glory and praise of God. God add blessing and understanding to the reading of these words. My message today is entitled The Fear-Love Relationship. And this is my prayer, that your love may overflow. Paul's prayer to the church in Philippi, and by extension to us, is that our love may overflow. Biblically speaking, this makes perfect sense. Jesus himself said the single most important rule for us to follow was to love God and to love our neighbor just as we love ourselves. Of course, Jesus isn't the only spiritual leader who espoused this kind of thing. Just to name a few, Buddha says, radiate boundless love towards the entire world, above, below, and across, unhindered, without ill will, without enmity. And from Islam's hadith, you will not enter paradise until you have faith, and you will not have faith until you love one another. Do you want me to tell you something you can do to make you love one another? Make it a habit to greet one another with Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you. Now, the problem we run into in all of these teachings is actually defining love. I mean, I absolutely love Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream, but that's certainly not the same love that I have for my kids. Even more problematic is the way we have slowly slipped into a perspective that being nice is somehow the same as being loving. I, for one, think that this may be partly responsible for the defining of Southern hospitality as a mile wide and an inch deep. Ultimately, it's far too easy to be nice to someone without loving them. Now, part of the problem is that We live in a society that has whole industries formed around selling us stuff about love. The majority of the education that we receive about love, about what love looks like, comes from them. How many of us on Valentine's Day or Mother's Day or Father's Day or on an anniversary buy cards and gifts? The industry's livelihood rests in its ability to condition us on what we believe about love, how we believe it should be expressed, and ultimately what we believe love looks like. Theirs is is a perspective whose interest isn't actually in communicating anything real about love. Rather, its primary goal, and possibly only goal, is to sell products. So, while we recognize that Paul's prayer was that our love overflow, and while we know that many of the great spiritual teachers taught us to love each other at all times, if we stop to think about it for just a minute, we really can't do those things. Because we really have some pretty unhealthy perspectives about love. Perspectives that we may have learned from places like Hallmark and Godiva chocolates. So, I think it might be reasonable here on this Advent Sunday where we're considering love to consider this question. What does love look like? Now keep in mind, we're not talking about Kodak moments here. We're not talking about the stuff that sells cards and chocolates. We're not talking about the precious gurgle in a baby's laugh, an embrace from the one we love, or even a moonlit walk on the beach. Those are all coming from places of love. But what does love itself look like? How do we conceptualize, think about love? That is, how do we understand it beyond the easy platitudes that make us feel good? Biblically speaking, if I have prophetic powers and understanding all mysteries and knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to move mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. Mother Teresa tells us we can do no great things, only small things with great love. Thich Nhat Hanh tells us we all have the seeds of love in us. Voltaire says love is a canvas furnished by nature and embroidered by imagination. In reaction to anti-gay demonstrators holding signs up that say God hates fags, one person commented, "What part of love is kind, don't they understand? Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things." Well, that's all nice. But can you, after hearing it, tell me anything more about what love looks like? Probably not. Part of the problem is that our commercially induced understanding of love is just far too simple. You see, there are too many kinds of love to summarize love in a commercial jingle, a quick saying, or a clever rhetorical refrain. Because love changes. Love is constantly alive, so we must be constantly willing to learn to love every day in every way. We can't just figure it out once and think that we're all finished. In some ways, love is an art, a skill that must be practiced every day, or we lose our ability to understand it and live into it as fully as God desires for us. Each single day without practice of spiritual reflection about love, each single day without that reflection on love puts us two days behind where we should be, because even as we lose one day of practice, love has grown a day in a new, wonderful, and unimaginable way. Love is about relationship. When we love something or somebody, we tend to draw it near us. Use as an example, me and that bowl of Reese's Peanut Butter Cup ice cream. When I see it, I am likely to draw it near me. Now, admittedly, it's a little bit of a silly example, but it does make a point. When you show someone love, they are likely to be drawn near you. When you show someone the opposite of love, they are likely to be pushed away. So, an interesting thing to consider is what the opposite of love is. Is it hate? If love is about relationship, drawing something near to us, is hate about a lack of or a denial of relationship, pushing something away. Let's go back to that bowl of Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream. Ever since my metabolism headed south, I have had sort of a love-hate relationship with ice cream. Now, given the choice, I am more likely to pull that bowl towards me than push it away. I'd much prefer to be in relationship with that than not. So, I kind of have to say that hate's not the opposite of love, which is odd. Normally, we do think that hate is the opposite of love. But hate doesn't always cause us to avoid relationship. Sometimes it pulls it to us. Hate doesn't always cause us to send something away. Sometimes it causes us to be drawn towards it. So, what does cause us to avoid relationship? What does cause us to send something away? Well, as I started last week's message saying, I'd suggest that the opposite of love is fear. Sometimes hate is a byproduct of fear, but so are resentment and repulsion and judgment and self-protection and all other sorts of unhealthy ways that we sometimes relate to each other. If I were to have a fear of ice cream, heaven forbid, if I were to have a fear of ice cream, you wouldn't be able to get me into the same room as a bowl of Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream. Ultimately, fear is about the end of, destruction of, avoidance of relationship. Fear intensifies our sense of separation. Fear intensifies our sense of aloneness. Fear leads us away from love. Fear opposes, is the opposite of love. The amazing thing is we fight, struggle, demand to hold on to our fear. There are those right now who are saying, that's just really a bit too simple of a view, or that's kind of naive, which is really fascinating. It's really fascinating. We have actually learned to be afraid of losing our fear. So we defend it. We justify it. We fight for it. We say, how naive, or it just isn't that easy. Not only do we demand to hold on to our fear, the thing that keeps us from love, but we also paint our fear over, disguising it as things like self-preservation and morality, even God's will. We house our fear of rejection and failure under the excuse of self-preservation. We justify our fear of people who are different from us simply as moral judgment. We even rationalize our fear of death among numerous other fears as God's will. We've fooled ourselves. We have fooled ourselves, and in doing so, we've denied ourselves the one thing that can help. It can help in those things as self-preservation, morality, and even in knowing God's will. That one thing is love. We fear losing our fear. We convince ourselves that we need fear. We convince ourselves that somehow the thing that intensifies our sense of separation and prevents us from fully knowing love, we've convinced ourselves that that fear somehow keeps us safe. All the while we come to church and read about the God who is love, not the God who is fear. All the while we come to church and read about the messengers of God, angels appearing before us, and what do they say? Almost without fail, the first things they say, the primary message of celestial beings have for humanity is, do not fear. All the while we come to church and read about Jesus teaching us to love God and to love our neighbor as ourselves. If we fear either God or neighbor, we cannot have a full relationship with either. If we fear either God or neighbor, we can truly never love fully either. Love? Love is not a luxury in life, but a necessity if we are to survive as a population. If we cannot love, fear will win the day, and we will turn on each other over things as small as getting our own way, or as slight as the name that we use to describe God. Love. Love is what we were formed by, conceived, and created for. Love is what life, what God, is about. Love is one of the most profound human experiences. It's one of the noblest aspirations. When we finally achieve some form of that inner spirituality of love, when there is no longer a domination of fear in us, when we can move from that all too human perspective of judgment, self-protection, and all the other unhealthy fruit that we sometimes produce as we relate to each other and replace it with something more godlike, something that's a truer reflection of the fruit that God calls us to bear, something that lives into Jesus' plea to us to love God and to love in the same way our neighbor, we will begin to move in the direction God has intended for us all. Now, let's come back to Paul's prayer. And this is my prayer, that your love may overflow. Within the context of the books of Philippians, we see that what Paul wants for people is to be genuine, honest, sincere, and to be faultless, that is, to have a clear conscience. He wants us to leave behind our tendency to hide behind the facade of the rigid use of laws, of tradition, of personal opinions and judging others, because he sees that is the opposite of showing love. The last part of today's scripture makes it clear what matters the most for Paul. It is having people live lives which produce fruits of righteousness and justice. It's the exact loving disposition that we see demonstrated in the life of Jesus. His understanding of praising God has much less to do with hymns and songs and rules, and it has to do with the way that we interact with each other. Yes, even those we may consider enemies. Living a life of love, letting every action and interaction you have with people be about caring for them rather than judging them, building them up rather than tearing them down, helping them out rather than tossing them out. That kind of life is the exact life we see in the story of the birth of the baby we anticipate on Advent. It's the core value in the teachings of the man that that child became. It reminds us of the death of that same man who said, "No greater love has anyone than this, than they lay down their life for the love of friends." What Paul's trying to get at here is this. The thing that matters the most in this life is what you have done here on earth, how you have treated others, not just family and friends, but particularly how you've treated strangers. The love you show matters more than anything. His prayer to the church in Philippi, and by extension to us, is that the fruit we produce in our relationships, the way we show kindness, caring, and genuine forgiveness, will give cause for us to be pure and blameless. That is, to have a clear conscience in knowing we have always tried to respond to all people from a place of love. Now, that would suggest that we need to constantly do interpersonal relationship evaluations. Think back over your conversations, your interactions, and even your casual acquaintances from this past week, and ask yourself, did I show love to them? Did I act as Jesus or Buddha or the Dalai Lama or other spiritual leaders might have acted? Was I understanding, kind, caring, forgiving? What fruit did I bear? The Christmas story tells us that on that day, love came down and a child was born. Flesh of our flesh, bone of our bone, and as he grew, he taught us about love. As he died, he taught us about love. How then could we think that this life, this brief diversion on our journey to God, how could we think that this life is about anything else but love? Learning to love, learning to share love, learning to overcome greed, need, and self-preservation for the higher sake of love, well, that is the message of Christmas. And the reason that we must not rush through Advent just to get to Christmas. Because you see, yes, it is the message of Christmas, but it is a lesson that humanity has not yet fully learned. So we need to have a time to long for it. Much like our spiritual ancestors long for the one who would come from the stump of Jesse. The good news is this. While it is now Advent and we wait for love to come down, in reality, the Christmas story tells us that love has already come down. That we, if we are willing to turn away from fear and our unloving ways, we can enter into a much fuller and satisfying life experience. Not only that, but in doing so, we can play a part of making life a much fuller and satisfying experience for others. It's the exact love that we celebrate and remember at this table. So, my prayer for you and for me is that our love may overflow.